Welcome to Inside the Chrysalis. So our goal for this podcast is to introduce and discuss psychological concepts in the context of the real world. And today's podcast is what I call a hot take. And this is where we analyze a current event or situation for psychological concepts that might be useful to the audience at large. So today's hot take, we're discussing, as you might have guessed, the coronavirus. More specifically, we're discussing the intersection of coronavirus, boredom, and motivation. So I'm your host, Dr. Michelle Quist, and I'm an assistant teaching professor at Penn State. My research area is actually in motivation, so I'm super excited to jump into this. Joining me today, I have three guests. First, I have Dr. Erin Westgate. Erin, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Erin. I'm a social psychologist and an assistant professor at the University of Florida. I study boredom, interest, and thinking, and why we tend to be so bad at it.
Awesome. That sounds great. And then I also have Erin's grad student that's starting in the fall, Yijun Lin. Yijun, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Yijun Lin, and I will start my PhD at University of Florida this fall. And as you know, Erin is my supervisor, and my research mostly focuses on procrastination and motivation and other emotions.
That's fantastic. I could definitely stand to read some research on procrastination because that dogs my very existence. And then the third guest I have today is Dr. Miley Steers. Miley, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Miley Steers, and I am an assistant professor in the School of Nursing at Duquesne University. My research deals with how social media influences health, or social media usage influences health specifically. And I'm really looking forward to our topic today.
Awesome. Welcome, Miley. Okay, so welcome, everyone. I want to start off the podcast today asking Erin and Yijun, could you, I see this article, I've got this article here, Corona Boredom Got You Down, Here Are Six Solutions. So Erin and Yijun, why don't you start off by telling us about boredom?
Sure. So boredom is this really common everyday feeling that we think leads to a lot of really common everyday behaviors. If you look at how often people experience it, it's only like 3 or 5% of the time, and that doesn't seem that bad. But when you add it up, it's almost 30 minutes every day, even when we're not experiencing lockdowns due to coronavirus. And what seems to happen with boredom is that it's especially problematic in situations where you're constrained and where you can't really change your situation. So it's a big problem in the workplace, where it leads to a lot of problems with worker morale and well-being. It's a big problem in schools. Students get bored from elementary school to middle school on up through college, and bored students don't do very well. They tend to miss class when they're in class. They don't learn what they're there to be learning. So there's this kind of lay intuition and a growing body of evidence to support it that boredom lies behind a lot of these really destructive social behaviors, things like self-harm and addiction and substance use. And it's a particular concern, I think, right now, given that so many of us are in this situation of constraint, where we're really asking, are we more bored than normal? And if we are, what is that doing? So it's somewhat surprising to me, at least, that given all this, that psychology hasn't paid more attention to boredom. There's this kind of sense that sometimes boredom causes all these bad things to happen, but that it also maybe causes these good things to happen, things like creativity and self-expression and associative thought. But we haven't historically had a really good sense of whether boredom is good or whether it's bad, in part because we haven't had a really good sense of what boredom is. And that's what a lot of my work has focused on, is coming in and saying, okay, before we understand what boredom does, we really have to understand what it is and how can we use that information to make sense of when people get bored, why they experience it, and then what happens when it does, we do. And so what we think is there's sort of one school of thought that says, okay, we feel bored when we can't pay attention to what we're doing. And that seems to be very true. If you look at the evidence, people do feel bored if they can't pay attention, either because what they're doing is too easy for them or because it's too hard. But there's also evidence that people feel bored when what they're doing doesn't feel personally meaningful to them. So this isn't like big M meaning in life. It's just like the sense that what I'm doing right now feels meaningful to me in the moment. And we think that happens when what you're doing matches up with these valued goals in your life, whether those goals are big things like getting a job or little things like getting coffee. But when things are meaningful and you're able to pay attention, because it's sort of that Goldilocks fit, it's not too hard and it's not too easy, people feel interest and enjoyment, and they don't really feel bored. And all of that leads us to think that what boredom is it's a really important emotion and signal that we're not meaningfully engaged in the world, either because we can't pay attention, that what we're doing is too hard or too easy, or because, yeah, we can pay attention just fine, but who cares? It's not meaningful to us at all. So boredom is really about these two key ingredients. You need to be able to pay attention. You need to be able to find what you're doing meaningful. And if you're short on one of those things, you're going to be bored. And that boredom is a signal to you that something is wrong. So boredom may not be pleasant. None of us really enjoy being bored, but it's a really important signal that what we're doing right now isn't meaningful, or that we're not engaging our attention in it successfully. And that we either need to do something to fix that, to find a way to make it meaningful, to find a way to make it easier or harder, so it's that optimal challenge for us. Or we need to just stop and do something else and hope that by doing something else that we can find a way to bring meaning and attention back into our lives. So a lot of my work up to this point has been looking at what causes boredom. And we've come to this sort of sense that this is what boredom is. And what we've started to do now, and what's really relevant and exciting on a professional level, I realize the coronavirus and COVID-19 is terrible for many, many people, but it's exciting professionally because so many of us are bored right now that it's letting us look at what happens once people are bored. How does that affect our behavior? How does it change our preferences? What are sort of the downstream consequences of being bored? And what determines whether we react in good ways to that or in bad?
Wow. Okay. So there's a lot there. Let me see. All right. So I'm kind of hearing this first thing about the impact of boredom. Like, is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? And then the sort of the makeup of boredom, like what is it exactly and what does that mean for us? And then how can we avoid it, whether it does good things or bad things for us? So how can we kind of fix it or utilize it? And then finally, the intersection of boredom and coronavirus specifically that we're looking at right now.
Yeah, I sometimes jokingly say that I study like, what is boredom? Why do we experience it? And what happens when we do? And then you can add on top of that all, like, especially in the time of COVID-19, I suppose.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So when you first started talking about being bored, the picture that immediately came to mind for me was little kids, like when they complain to their mom that they're bored. And I don't know about everybody else, but my mom would always come up with chores. You know, if you say you're bored, she's like, oh, I got some stuff for you can do, you know, you can go wash the dishes or whatever. But I'm thinking about kids and times when I would feel bored, and then other times when I would play, you know, just by myself in my own imagination or with toys or whatever. And I guess if I'm really thinking about it, I can't necessarily tease apart the difference between the times when I entertain myself and the times when I felt bored. So it sounds like what you're saying is that comes down to feeling like what you're doing matters and feeling like you can actually do something?
Yeah, so something I think that is underappreciated is that to find something meaningful, you have to be doing something to begin with. Like for most people, there are those of us who, I'm not one of these people, but there are people who are really good at meditating or simply being alone with their own thoughts, which is actually another thing that I study. But for most of us, finding something meaningful means doing something, and something that we think, there's not surprisingly a lot of good data on boredom in children, but something that we think may be challenging for kids is that they have a lot of constraints on what their available options are. There's lots of things that are off limits because of their developmental stage. There's lots of things that are off limits just because they need parental supervision and parents aren't there to supervise. And because kids are often in this situation where there's a limited set of activities available to them, it may be harder for them to dial in on activities that are sort of a good fit for where they're at, not too easy, not too hard, and meaningful to them. And it's even sort of a question that I'm really interested in, which is, do children know what their values are in a way that lets us as adults say, like, well, I really care about this thing, so I'm going to do something that is congruent with that? I don't know that kids are able to self-regulate in those ways, especially younger children. So part of what,
one of the things that sparked in my head was maybe it has to do with self-exploration. Like you're exploring your identity as a kid, you're deciding what those values are, what the things you really like. And so boredom is just sort of part of that thing. You just found something and you did it for a long time and you got good at it, or you got, you know, kind of used to it. And then you need to find something else to move on to. So you get bored in between as part of that exploration process.
Yeah. And I have a pet theory there. I would love to see research on this, that one thing boredom might tell us, but especially kids, is it may be a kind of feedback. Like if you don't know, if you don't have like a self-elaborated like schema of the things that you care about or don't care about, if you try something and you feel bored, that might be information for you and be like, okay, so when I watch ocean documentaries, I feel really excited and interested. But when I watch train documentaries, I feel really bored. Maybe that means I don't like trains. So sort of using almost sort of a self-observation, self-perception approach that lets boredom sort of help you figure out what those things are that you care about in the first place.
Right. Right. Hey, listeners. So at this point in the recording, the four of us totally geeked out about research for the better part of an hour. We had a really great time doing it, but it was a little bit more in-depth and off focus of what we were trying to do with this particular episode. If you're interested in deep diving with us, we're going to offer that section as a bonus to our Patreon subscribers, along with a mini primer that will explain some of the concepts that we're discussing. For now, though, we're going to take a short break and then get back to COVID and boredom. So stay tuned. Yijun, talk to us about boredom and procrastination. What are you seeing?
Yeah, actually, I'm not an expert of boredom. I already saw many research about the relationship between boredom and procrastination. Issues like if people feel boredom, they are more likely to procrastinate at something.
Let me interrupt for just a second. Can you explain that mechanism? Because I feel that like when I am bored, I'm more likely to procrastinate, and it doesn't make intuitive sense to me because it feels like when you're bored, that's when you should be like, hey, I'm going to go do this thing, because then you won't be bored anymore because you're doing this thing. So can you explain the mechanism as to why procrastination leads to, or I'm sorry, why boredom leads to procrastination?
Yeah, I can explain from my own experience. So first, I feel bored, maybe just because like for COVID-19, maybe just because I feel like nervous, anxious about the current situation. So I don't have enough like self-regulation or attention resources to cope with those things. So I feel bored. And also for procrastination, we also need those self-regulation resources to push ourselves to start those maybe difficult tasks.
I see.
Yeah.
So it's almost like resource management. Like if you don't have the resources to engage in those things, like Aaron was talking about, you don't have the resources to engage in activities, then you are likely to be bored because you kind of are at a place where you can't do that thing. And then you'll also procrastinate because if you don't have the resources to do that, then you're bored and you procrastinate because you don't have the resources to do whatever it is that you feel like you need to do.
Yeah. That's my understanding of this case.
Interesting. So I have a pet theory that I just came up with in the last 10 minutes. This is social psychologist theorizing on the fly, people. So when you were talking, Aaron, about boredom and with boredom as an emotion, you were talking about what we can do and what we feel is meaningful. And so, of course, as a motivation researcher, my mind was just screaming self-determination theory and basic psychological needs. So we're talking about these three needs that we have of autonomy, this need to be in charge of what we're doing. And then we're talking about competence, this need to feel optimally challenged. And I noted that you used that phrase specifically. And then relatedness, this need to have meaningful relationship. Talk to me about coronavirus and boredom. I know you've got the article that I will link in the show notes for anybody who wants to read it. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that.
So I think you have it exactly right, that what's happening right now is that we're seeing a huge amount of variability where parents working at home with small children, I suspect, are not terribly bored. Certainly people who are doing essential jobs, our healthcare professionals who are on the front lines, are not bored. But many of us are at home. We've lost our normal routines that structure our lives. We may have lost some of the things that give us a sense of autonomy, competence, and relatedness in our lives. And when you put that all in a bundle where then you have to stay home and you can't do anything about it, I think the result, anecdotally, and we're starting to look at empirically as well to see whether this is the case and it plays out in the data, is that people are getting bored, which I always say is so strange. We were talking earlier about forecasting. If you had asked me 1 year ago, no, not even a year ago, if you'd asked me 2 months ago, hey, Erin, there's going to be a global pandemic in 2 months. What do you think you're going to feel? I would have said I'll be scared or nervous, or maybe I'll be like excited because like I want to see what's happening. I don't think I would have said I'd be bored. And I think that's part of what's so strange about this is that it feels in a weird way, like existentially odd to feel bored in the midst of a giant historical, in many ways, deeply frightening and dangerous event going on around us. But
I totally agree with that. I feel like a lot of it is that juxtaposition because like on one hand, you read the news and you see news stories come across, you hear stories from people, personal testimonies, and there's this really epic, terrible thing happening and people are dying and people are getting sick and people are having terrible experiences. The economy is having trouble. People are going broke, all of these terrible things. And yet I'm bored because I personally have nothing to do.
I know. Doesn't it make you feel terrible?
Yes, exactly. It feels like this terrible juxtaposition of this sense of what I should be feeling compared to what I actually am feeling.
For me, I kind of vacillate also, and I wanted to ask you about this, Erin. I vacillate between terror, like especially since I have a young child, and then my husband, he has a pre-existing condition, which makes him more like if he were to get coronavirus, he might be really affected by that. But to me, I seem to vacillate between terror about what's going on and boredom. And it's just this weird juxtaposition between these two emotions that are diametrically opposed normally. But I feel like I'm experiencing it all at once. And then, you know, and I'm someone who has a young child. I have a 3-year-old. And so in some ways, I feel like I'm kind of lucky in that way because with young children, it forces you to have a routine. It forces you to kind of continue life as you were before in some semblance because you need to maintain a routine for your child and that consistency. But then I sort of vacillate between this terror and then boredom.
You know, I felt the same way. And I feel like I have a sense, I don't know that this makes it better. It makes me feel better that this paradox, in a sense, is something you see all throughout history in anybody experiencing really intense events. So like if you think about like soldiers at war, like, right, the traditional phrase is that war is 99% boredom and 1% terror. Earlier this year, I was looking at jobs that are really high risk of boredom due to automation. And apparently anesthesiologists talk about the same thing, that their jobs are mostly boring except for when they're completely terrifying. And I think there is a really, really strange sense in which historically it is a really odd, complete polar opposite juxtaposition, but it's also deeply true throughout history and throughout situations that involve a lot of dangers that nothing is incredibly dangerous 100% of the time. And so it's more like the awareness that something might happen, but nothing's happening now and nothing's happening now. But you know that at any moment, something like the most terrible thing could happen.
Right. So you have that, you're just constantly on, you know, you're physiologically aroused all the time because you have to just wait for something.
And something that I think is underappreciated is we often have this sort of lay sense that boredom is a low arousal emotion, as we call it, that you don't have a lot of physiological arousal going on. But when you actually look at the data, that's not true at all. That sometimes sometimes boredom's low arousal, but just as many studies find it's high arousal, and the remaining like third of studies find that sometimes it's high, sometimes it's low. And so I think
I did not know that. Yeah, that's really interesting.
It's one of sort of the big questions out there, I'd say, right now in like boredom research, which is why do we see that pattern? Like, why is it both? And I think the answer is that emotions are all super variable, but we have sort of ideas and prototypes of what an emotion looks like. And our prototype for boredom is not something that you experience in a time of terror, that it's completely different. And I think that goes back to the point, Miley, that you were raising about, you know, you can be terrified one moment and then bored the next moment, because something that we talk about in emotion research is that any emotion is about whatever is in mind at the time. That if you're thinking about the danger and the possible consequences and what could happen to your family, yeah, that is going to be terrifying. But we don't think about those things 100% of the time, all the time. A lot of the time, what's in our conscious awareness immediately is what's in front of us at the moment. It's about, you know, needing to run a bath or go let the dog out, or yet again, for the 100th time today, walking around the house because there's nowhere else to go. And when that sort of terrifying, you know, the news headlines aren't in our focal awareness, we're not going to be thinking about them. But if we're not thinking about them, we're not going to be feeling about them either, if that makes any sense.
Right.
And so I think that can lead to a lot of really, at least for me, jarring swings in how you're feeling, where you can really go from feeling deeply bored at one moment to then queuing up the New York Times and being like, oh my goodness, we're at, like just earlier today, I saw that we're almost at 1 million cases in the US now. And it was like, whoa.
Right.
Whoa.
So I wonder, I was talking last night with another group of researchers, and one of the things that we brought up was that in the middle of this pandemic and in the middle of all of this, knowing that all this really heavy stuff, emotionally laden stuff is happening, that the things that we normally would consider to be little wins, I got a thing accepted for publication, or I lost some weight, or I, you know, any of these things that are minor things, that it feels like we can't enjoy them as much because they pale in comparison to the epic bad that's happening. So I wonder if that boredom terror juxtaposition is that the things that we normally would find meaning in that would help us not experience boredom, just the meaning isn't there in the face of this terror.
I absolutely think that's the case. We know that upward and downward social comparison matters immensely for happiness, for instance, right? And I right. think it matters for meaning just as much. That, you know, one of my colleagues here at Florida had a big paper accepted, and he texted me and was like, I just had this big paper accepted, period. And I was like, where's your exclamation mark? And he was like, I just can't bring myself to care. Like, who cares about the little games that we play? And of course, he was totally underselling. It was great work. It matters. But it didn't feel like it mattered in the face of a global catastrophe and people's lives being lost.
And absolutely.
I had
the same kind of experience. That it was last night that an editor for a textbook that I'm writing, the editor came back with the advice, or I'm sorry, with comments on the first chapter. And the comments were all really glowing. Oh, this is so great and everything. But it kind of felt like braggy to tell anybody, because we're in the middle of all of this. Like at another time in my life, I would have been like, oh my gosh, you know, I got these comments and they're so great. And I would have been excited about it. But like, I didn't want to tell anybody because it felt like a dumb thing to bring up when there's people dying, you know?
It does. And I suspect that we're robbing ourselves of some joy when we do that. I feel the same way. And I think it's both ways. One, I think on a personal level, it feels less meaningful and it brings us less enjoyment and satisfaction and pleasure because it's weighed against, you know, the things happening in the world right now. But then I think you really bring up a really nice point, which is that we don't want to tell other people, which means that, you know, a lot of the joy and success and good things happening comes from social capitalization, from telling other people and sharing that with other people. And everything about how we share anything with other people has been totally disrupted right now.
Right.
Much less like sharing good news, right? Especially like, you know, one of my very, very closest friends is an OBGYN at a hospital down in Texas. And when he's coming off of a shift, like treating, you know, mothers who are testing positive for COVID-19, I feel really bad being like, hey, I had a really good writing day today.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Like it feels so inconsequential in light of this really hugely meaningful, hugely big thing happening in all of our lives. And you know, I think it really comes down to our construals, that when we have this thing to compare with, the stuff that seemed big doesn't seem so big anymore. And that can be a good thing in some ways. I think it has made some of the problems we have seem less problematic. I got a rejection on a paper recently and I was kind of like, okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
Who cares?
Yeah. I guess that's the other side too. It's like when something bad happens, you're like, well, okay, that, you know, it pales in comparison to the big bad that is going on.
It does, but it swings both ways. And I think that makes it hard.
Right.
I think the other thing that makes it hard is, on the one hand, many of the things that we do have been robbed of their meaning because of that. But also, like I think we were talking about earlier, you can't really block out mentally what's happening at some level. And that sort of constant buzz mentally and that constant awareness is exhausting. And boredom is partly about cognitive resources and attention. And all of us are essentially functioning under a giant naturalistic cognitive load experiment right now. And
yeah,
I think that's thrown all of us off balance, that the things that normally work for us don't, and that catches us by surprise and we don't quite know how to fix it. Those feelings catch us off guard. We don't know how to get back to baseline. And then the things that normally feel meaningful, now they don't because of this whole thing that's happening around us. And so I think that can really... It can create a lot of boredom. It can also, I think, create sort of an almost more existential sort of feeling of disturbance of things aren't right and I don't know quite how to get back there.
Right. And there's nothing I can do.
Which I don't know if that's entirely true. I think there are things that we can do, but it's not always obvious. A lot of us have a difficult time with emotion regulation at the best of times, right?
And right.
Definitely not the best of times.
Absolutely.
I do have a question. So getting back to the whole idea of boredom, and so now nowadays, it seems like everybody is streaming Netflix shows and, you know, Disney Plus or what have you. And what's kind of interesting to me is the fact that even though we're entertaining ourselves and we're kind of numbing ourselves to what's going on, we're still bored. You know, it's kind of like that whole proverbial, you know, kids in the car, they're watching TV in the back seat of a SUV or whatever. And then they're still going on this huge car ride and they're just like, are we there yet? You know what I mean? I'm just kind of wondering, like, how that plays into the whole idea of boredom. And in fact, there's a petition now on change.org where people are trying to petition for all these streaming services to be free to the public as a public good to alleviate the general public from boredom.
My God.
Yeah.
So one of the things I like to distinguish, and I think we've been circling around this issue repeatedly in this conversation, is that there's good ways and bad ways to address boredom. And I sometimes make the distinction between interesting activities and enjoyable activities, that when you're bored, you can kind of do something enjoyable or you can do something that's interesting. And interest and enjoyment are similar in many ways. In everyday language, we kind of use them interchangeably, but they have some really important differences. So things that are familiar and comforting to us in the past and easy, we often find enjoyable. But things that are novel and complex that we don't entirely get, but we think we can, we find those things interesting. So Paul Sylvia has this fantastic quote that interest is about those things which are not yet understood, but are understandable. We feel like we can get there, we just haven't quite yet. And I think that one thing that is nice about enjoyable options like Netflix, God knows I've been guilty of it. I've been watching The Witcher and I just watched The Two Popes, which was fantastic. But the thing about enjoyable options is they do make you feel better in the moment. And sometimes that's all that you can do. You know, if you're really exhausted and you just don't have the cognitive capacity to do more, like, that's fine. Just give yourself a break. But they don't really feed those needs for deeper meaning, and they don't build you up in any way. And sometimes they're kind of like cognitive junk food. Like, they're nice sometimes, they make you feel better, but they don't give you any new knowledge. They don't give you any new resources or skills. And so what happens is that once they go away, you just feel bored again. It's like the kids in the car, where as long as they're watching the movie and the movie's good, they're okay. But then the movie goes away and they're back to being bored again. It doesn't really address or fix any of the problems that led us to be bored in the first place. And the nice thing about interesting activities, the sort of challenging, novel, complex things, is that they have the potential to really pay off with long-term change and really give you skills to find new things interesting. They open up doors that weren't there before, and they fix those deficits that caused you to be bored in the first place, that you're less likely to be bored again down the road. The trade-off is that they're hard. Interest requires a lot of cognitive resources, and that may be especially hard at times like this, when like all of us are kind of under a cognitive load and not really functioning at our best. The other part that's really interesting to me is that they're risky, that doing something interesting might pay off and actually be really interesting. Or it might turn out that it is too hard for you at the moment. If it's too hard for you, it's going to be boring. I think we've all had the experience of watching some some foreign film, art film that's all in subtitles and totally nonlinear. And it's this, amazing, incredible experience if you're in the right place to see it. But if you're not, you're just sitting there like sort of baffled and confused and deeply bored in the movie theater.
It's like pretty much anything my husband wants to watch.
Oh dear, I'm so sorry. he's just trying to keep you from being bored in the log ride. But yeah, right?
He's like, let's watch this documentary. And I'm like, that's good. I need a good nap.
Exactly. Those things are great if you can sort of wring the interest out of them, they're great, but otherwise they're not. And I think that's really especially challenging right now, because things like Netflix and these things that make us feel better in the moment but don't fix the deeper problems, they only make us feel better as long as we're doing them. And then once we stop doing them, we're back to the same problem again. So it can be this kind of sort of almost like a treadmill or a feedback loop where you're bored, so you try to distract yourself from it, but you don't really fix the boredom. Then you stop doing the thing and then you're bored again. And it feels like you're stuck in a sense.
So in my other project that I was talking about earlier, the Chrysalis Project, I call them passions and patterns. So passions being those things that are interesting, the intrinsic enjoyment, the things that you do because you just enjoy it and they restore you and give back to you, versus patterns, the things that you do by habit that you just fall into. Netflix is great for this because they have the autoplay feature where you just it run, right? And so you're not enjoying, you're not engaging. It's not this level of entertainment, even though it's technically in the entertainment category, you're not actually being that entertained by it anymore. You're not even really there. It's just this pattern of behavior. So that dynamic between things that feed you and things that really just are just kind of there and take up your time resources.
I really like that.
I do have a kind of a segue into that. How do you, or what do you do when you've kind of lost your mojo? Because you're so bored, you fall into this whole Netflix trap of just spending your days not wearing pants, in front of the TV, right?
Scene.
Let me stop you right there, because I think that would be a great thing to get into next, into the 6 solutions that she has on the article. And we can talk about that whole phenomenon of the pandemic and corona boredom and all of that. But we're going to take a short break first, and then we will come right back and get into that topic. I think that's exactly where we should go next. So we'll be right back. And so we're back. So Miley, go ahead and ask your question again to Erin, and let's see what she has to say.
I was just wondering, Erin, as a boredom researcher, how do you get back your mojo if you're in this cycle of boredom?
As a boredom researcher, I should be better at this. I'm ridiculously bad at making myself not bored. So I wrote down a set of recommendations for myself. And I shared my set of recommendations with a friend, and my friend was like, you should write that up and tell people about it. And so essentially what the answer is, one, I think you have to have some amount of motivation and decision to be like, I'm going to do something. Because one of the things that's really easy when you're bored is just to sort of stay stuck in that pattern of whatever it is that you've been doing, that kind of holding pattern. But what I usually recommend that people do is to think about what are the things that you could be doing and why are you not doing them? So I actually like to draw out a grid, things that are meaningful and things that are easy. So meaningful, easy activities and meaningful, difficult activities. And at least for me, I find that most of the things that I do that are really meaningful are also things that require a lot of energy. So, you know, like I love reading like really traditional literature. I love reading, this is, I guess, embarrassing. I love reading like journal articles, like for fun. There's all these sorts of things that, or like photo editing. There's all these things I like to do, but they're all really hard and exhausting. They give me a deep sense of meaning, but they're not great options when I'm really tired. And so I think what's really helpful is to have options in both columns, meaningful high effort activities and meaningful low effort activities. And it may take some thinking about what a meaningful low effort activity is. They exist, but we're not always good at identifying them and finding those and sort of letting yourself pick those options when that is all you're sort of up for. So for me, for instance, one of those things is cooking. Cooking for me is pretty like rote. It's pretty, honestly, I don't do it a lot because it's usually a little bit too understimulating and boring. But when I'm really tired, I realize that I actually get a deep sense of meaning out of cooking a meal from scratch. And it's something that doesn't require a lot out of me mentally. And so it's a really good option for me when I'm bored and in that sort of mode where I like don't even want to get up off the couch and do anything about it. It's like, okay, well, what can I do that's really easy that's still going to give me a sense of meaning that I'm up for at the moment? And I literally have a list of these things on the refrigerator now that I go and turn to. Because I think that one of the challenges is that when you're in that box, it's really hard to even expend the energy to think about the things that might be a good fit for you at the moment.
That's really interesting because as a motivational researcher, my process is very, very similar to that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So what I do is I think about who I want to be at that moment. What values do I want to embody? You know, am I embodying this relatedness kind of a basic need where I'm embodying the relationships that I want to nurture? Or is it, you know, my creative side? Is there something there that I'm trying to be? Like, who do I want to embody at that moment? And then I think about the things those values would do, the actions associated with those. And then I ask myself the question of what can I do with the resources that I have right now, with the cognitive resources, what can I actually do? Not what should. That's a very important distinction. Not should. What can
I
do?
It's critical. Yeah.
And I find that maps onto your grid actually really well, you know, this sense of what is giving me meaning in this moment and what do I have the resources to accomplish?
No, I really love that. One of the things I've been wanting to do, I haven't run this study, but is to essentially do an intervention type study where you give people almost a boredom toolbox where you basically get them to generate things in my grid. And I think, and one of the things I've thought about is something very similar to what you're suggesting right now, that starting with the values and the things that do give you meaning and then finding options that work for you, that I really like your distinction about what you can do at the moment. Not what you should or might want to do.
Yeah. Awesome.
One of the questions I had too for Erin is the fact that, okay, so people are getting stuck in these ruts of boredom. Are there things these concrete things of like little tasks that give you meaning and big tasks that give you meaning? But if you're in that big hole, how do you slowly get yourself out of that? You know what I mean? Because I feel like a lot of people are getting into the whole pattern of learned helplessness right now, where they're like, my life is just so overwhelming. I can't even begin to think of these little tasks or big tasks. How do I dig myself out of this hole?
So I'm not a clinical psychologist, but my understanding is that a lot of sort of the principles of behavioral activation are really consistent with a lot of what we think is happening with boredom and emotion, that it can be really helpful to literally just pick one really easy thing, like something you hear a lot, for instance, it's like make your bed every morning. Obviously, there's nothing magical about making your bed, but it's something easy and accomplishable and immediately visible that can help you get started down that road. One of the things I always suggest is that there are really, really easy things that give us a sense of meaning in our life that we don't realize do. So Samantha Heinzelman has really fantastic work showing that there's a difference between being stuck in a rut and having routines, that having good routines provides a sense of coherence that when you have a routine, like I wake up in the morning and I make coffee and then I take my dog out to throw the ball and then I go work in a little bit and then I break for lunch and then we go for a walk. But when you have these kinds of routines, they make it easier to concentrate on your day because it automates some of those big decisions. It takes sort of the effort out of it once it becomes habitual, but it also simply by being predictable and you know what's going to happen next, that makes everything have sense. She, for instance, finds that people who have more routine in their life report higher meaning in life. And if you sort of beep them throughout the day, that if you catch someone in the middle of going through one of their routines, their daily routines, that they report that their lives are more meaningful in that very moment compared to other moments during their day. And so one of the things I always suggest, and something that I've really tried to do right now, given everything that's going on, is keeping a routine, even if it's very minimal. Putting on pants is not part of my routine. I don't think it has to be something like that. But I do make coffee every morning. I do walk my dog every day at 2 p.m. And, you know, I think it's really funny to talk about routines in the context of boredom, because I think we sometimes have this idea that, like, oh my God, if you do the same thing every day, you're going to have a really boring life. And that's not necessarily the case, that if it's a routine that really provides a rhythm that structures your senses or provides a skeleton to build everything else on, but that actually provides more meaning and it gives you sort of the room to maneuver a little bit. So I think if I was, you know, stuck on the couch and didn't know what to do first, that might be a really easy place to start. Not a whole, you know, I'm going to do all these things all day, but just like pick one thing to do and then do it every day at that time. Even if it's something really basic, like call a friend or make coffee or whatever it is, check the newspaper. Start or your
put on pants, maybe.
Put on pants. No, let's not get wild.
You know, what's so funny is I was actually reading that in the state of Pennsylvania, which is the state that I'm in and Michelle's in, there has been a mandate from the law enforcement that says, please, when you're going to check your mail, wear pants.
Oh my God. So I live in Florida, and one of the things that I have been hilariously amused by, so I'm mostly living on my front porch at this point. I do put on pants before I go on the front porch. But one of the things I've been really amused by is that all of my neighbors appear to have slowly decided that, like, shirts are optional. So I would say that probably about half the guys that are walking down the street now, and everyone's out walking. It's something to do, I guess. And it's hot. It's we're like in the 80s and 90s here. People have just slowly sort of degenerated back into basically swimwear.
I have so many students that when they have their video on in our remote classroom, I see their dad walking behind them with no shirts on. I was like, oh, apparently a lot of American dads do not feel the need to wear shirts when they are at home.
No, it's great. My, you know, for both personal and professional reasons, I have a neighbor across the street who has discovered a routine. It's a great routine, but his routine is to walk out into his front yard around 8 a.m. and dance every morning. He's a lovely dude. There's no shirt involved in the dancing. But like, you know, and I think that brings me to another thing that I think we can all do that gives us a sense of meaning and reduces boredom, which is having those kinds of social connections. I think in one way, a lot of our social connections are cut off right now. The things that the people that you might normally talk to, and obviously we can't get together in person with people outside your own household. And, you know, there's virtual equivalents and those are great too. But I've been touched and surprised by the amount to which I've gotten to know my neighbors in the past few weeks. And without ever really approaching closer than like a dozen feet to them, you know, when people walk down the street, they wave to me on the front porch. My dancing neighbor across the street waves every morning when he finishes his routine. I have another neighbor who, we're all living in our front yards apparently, but she does yoga every morning. And these are people that I didn't know prior really to the pandemic, and I probably wouldn't have known. And I think looking at those opportunities and reaching out socially in ways that are safe and that don't involve, you know, obviously physical closeness at this point. But for most of us, even us introverts, there's actually great research. So I'm an introvert, and I hate and love this research that shows that even introverts, if you randomly assign them to go interact with people, are happier as a consequence, that they would be less motivated to do it. But yeah, it actually, you know, does pay off.
Yeah.
And I think social connections, there's great work showing that social connections are one of the most important sources of sort of everyday meaning in people's lives. And
yeah,
to the extent that even with the distancing guidelines, the extent that we can lean in to connecting with other people, I think that's inherently meaningful to most of us and inherently not boring.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking at your article that has the 6 tips, and I find that we've gone over most of them. There's the remind yourself why you're doing this, looking at this, finding the preferring doing something over doing nothing. So reminding yourself, why are we engaging in social distancing? And that can help stave off boredom. And then you talk about finding a rhythm, so that routine. You talk about trying something new, about guilty pleasures and connecting with others. There's one on here, though, that I would like to hear a little bit more depth about. You, number 3 is going with the flow. Can you talk a little bit about what going with the flow means?
Yeah. So I think this is something that we talked about a little bit earlier, which is that I think a lot of times when we're bored, we're almost too ambitious, that it's like, oh, I'm bored, I need to go learn how to become a master cupcake decorator, or, oh, I'm bored, I mean, like, we have these grandiose ideas of what we need to do to stop being bored. And then that's usually too much. And so we either just don't even attempt it because it seems overwhelming and we don't think we're going to succeed at it, or we do attempt it and it is too much and it doesn't work and we're bored again. And so I think there's a really important value in recognizing our own limits, that it's okay to try for the modest thing now, that, you know, calling up a neighbor, calling up a friend, calling up a family person, making coffee, doing something little now, if that's all you can do, is fine. And just knowing that your capacity for doing the big things versus the little things is off right now for all of us. I think as right. adults, most of us have a sense of what's too much or what's too little. And I think one of the really disorienting things right now is that that may or may not be true at the moment, at any given moment during our days.
So going with the flow is like being mindful or just aware of what you're doing, what resources it's taking, and if it's not meeting your needs, to scale back or try something else. But it's just like just paying attention basically to what's happening.
Yeah, I think,
within you.
I think paying attention and not blaming yourself for that. So something we see a lot with right. boredom is that people make what we call dispositional attributions, that they say, oh, I'm bored because of something that's wrong with me. And I think it's really important to, like, no. Like, sometimes, you know, I might be up for a big challenge in 1 hour, and an hour later I looked at the news and now I'm demoralized and exhausted, and that's okay. So I think just
been there.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Like yeah. practicing some self-compassion and being gentle with ourselves and recognizing that we're not in our normal space. We're not in our normal headspace at all. And that's going to ebb and flow, that there may be moments during our day when we are up for the big things, and there's going to be moments in our day when we're not, and not beating ourselves up about that, recognizing when it's happening and being okay with it and being willing to adjust maybe a little bit more than we normally have to, I think is helpful right now in sort of riding that wave of finding the meaningful things that you can do in the moment.
That brings me to the meme that is circulating around right now about how Isaac Newton basically came up with calculus during a pandemic, a plague, and kind of the pressures that we as academics kind of push on ourselves during this kind of time period too, where it's like you almost have to, you feel like you need to come up with that amazing, great, big idea. Although you, Aaron, maybe this will happen. This will be your moment. This will be your Isaac Newton moment. But
oh God, no.
No pressure.
It's the shoulds, right? We're tortured by shoulds. We should be doing this. Yeah,
that's an interesting thing that you bring that up, Miley, because I have kind of a dual reaction to that. Because when I see that the one about Isaac Newton, and then there's the other one about William Shakespeare, right? That he wrote King Lear when he was quarantined, and I found it to be inspiring. inspiring in the sense of I can reframe this time. Like instead of chafing at the constriction or restriction of what I can do, and instead of thinking, oh man, I wish I could be doing all these other things, I can reframe in, okay, but I am here now. And what can I do being here now? It doesn't have to be wasted or lost time. So that's when I first saw it, that's kind of what I was thinking. And I found it inspiring, but I definitely caught this other side of it that people were chafing against that means that it's pressure. It's expecting too much of ourselves or giving us something that's too hard to do. So I feel like there's kind of two different ways that you can go with that. And maybe that maps onto, Erin, what you were saying about different ways to handle boredom.
Yeah, no, it's almost like you can interpret it as this is something I could do or this is something I should do. And those are very different messages and different feelings.
Yeah. Can and should, I tell you.
Yeah.
It's small words, big difference.
No, absolutely. And, you know, I do want to touch on something that we kind of alluded to at the very beginning of this conversation, which is that these impacts of boredom, I think it's really important to consider who is feeling bored and who is in a position to deal with that in more or less productive ways, quote unquote. In that we know from research prior to the pandemic that the more privileged you are, the less likely you are to be bored because you have more control over your environment. And so ideally, yeah, maybe we'd all be in a position where we can respond to boredom with, you know, scientific breakthroughs or literary yes. breakthroughs. But I think recognizing that that's maybe something to aspire to, but that it's also a privileged position, that not all of us are going to be in that privileged position. And that's not a reflection on who we are as scholars or thinkers or academics or parents or whatever, is also really, really important.
Yes. I think that's really important to acknowledge, is we definitely are coming from a position of privilege. So, okay, as we wrap up, is there from anybody, Yijun, Erin, Miley, what advice would you give people right now if they are facing boredom in the pandemic? What would you say, this is what I think you should do?
To me, it seems like the most useful thing, at least coming from a person who has a young child, one of the benefits of having a young child is you have to maintain a routine, like Erin was saying. And I feel like, you know, you don't have the luxury of being bored because you have to maintain that routine and you have to maintain this balance of trying to work while simultaneously taking care of your child without any childcare and also juggling your spouse's working environment as well. So I think routine seems to me to be very important. Just being able to get up in the morning and putting on pants
and find that thing that you can do.
I feel like at least for me, that gives me a sense of autonomy, even though there's a lot of things that I can't do at the moment. But just being able to take control of my life, like you said, making my bed or making a cup of coffee, having that routine, and also kind of being more self-compassionate, because knowing that I'm really struggling like a lot of people are, and although I'm very privileged to be struggling in the way that I am, in that, you know, my husband and I are both working and, you know, trying to take care of our child at the same time, but whereas a lot of people don't have a job, but just being able to be appreciative too of the things that I do have. I think that kind of alleviates boredom for me, at least.
Okay. All right. Great.
Yeah, I'd agree with all of that. Something that I personally find helpful is reminding myself that boredom isn't good or bad. Boredom is a signal. It's trying to tell me this information. It's trying to tell me, like, hey, Erin, what you're doing right now, like, it doesn't feel meaningful to us. And reminding myself, I almost talk back to it a little bit, where I'm like, okay, I know that's what you feel, but actually what you're doing is really meaningful. It just doesn't always feel that way, that you are literally saving lives by staying home right now. That and really remembering that emotions are about our own thoughts and the ways that we construe the situations we're in, and working, I'm not always up to it, but work to the extent I am, working to remember that what we are all doing is extremely meaningful and that it's hard. And this is a little bit, I guess, of an mental acrobatics, but reminding myself that part of what makes it meaningful is that it's hard. That,
yes.
That there, I at least feel a sense of meaning in that, that like sitting here with my boredom and staying on the front porch and not giving to the urge to go to the beach because Florida's opened up its beaches again. That strangely enough makes the boredom better. It makes me feel a lot better, and it makes me feel okay with the boredom that I still feel even after that, just knowing that like I can mentally reframe and rethink what I'm doing, and that doing that changes how I feel about it.
Right. Just like in your experiment.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Yi Jun, do you have any advice?
Yeah, I agree with you two. Like the routine maybe is the most important thing, because like for me, I don't have a healthy routine for the past months. I sleep late and get up late, maybe in the afternoon. So I kind of lose the sense of control, so I can't focus on any work or other important things, meaningful things. And
yes.
Yeah. So I think the most important things is to reestablish my routine and sleep early and do some exercise. And also be self-compassionate is very important, because I did nothing, like nothing related to my work. So sometimes I feel guilty, but I don't want more negative emotions at this weird time. So I need to like self-compassionate about myself to
give yourself permission to not do those things.
Yeah, like this.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's great. So routine and self-compassion, I like both of that, and finding meaning. Aaron said, I'm going to go a little bit off message and say, find a hobby. I really think that's important. It has saved me a lot. Both me and my husband have picked up new hobbies. Well, he refound an old one, but I picked up a new one. And I think doing something just for the pure joy of doing it, it doesn't have to have any deeper meaning other than the fact that you like it. And it is a part of you, that I think that can be very helpful if you're bored, but also self-compassion for sure. Definitely. So great. Thank you so much, everyone, for being here. Miley and Aaron and Yijun, I have really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you for having us.
Before we go, I have to know, what's your new hobby?
Oh, crocheting.
Oh, yeah. My goodness. I love it.
Yeah. I taught myself to crochet. I say that like that's a big thing. It's really not hard, but yeah, I taught myself to crochet. So now I'm just, I've bought pretty much all the yarn there is in the world. And I have started crocheting stuff. So that's my new hobby.
That's wonderful.
I've been doing puzzles. You know what's really surprising? Out of the things that have come out of this whole crisis, one of the things that I've really struggled with finding is puzzles, because
everybody's doing puzzles.
But you know, it's kind of funny, because like we're going back to, I don't know, at least when I was a kid, you would do a 1,000 piece puzzle and feel like a sense of accomplishment, you know?
Yeah. I think definitely people are finding old things like that, that they used to get enjoyment out of and going back and doing those things. Yeah. So thank you everyone for being here. I appreciate it so much. I've really enjoyed this. Thank you also all you listeners for joining us today. Our podcast today was edited by Travis Woodley and produced by Travis and myself. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode and want to check out our supporting materials, such as Aaron's article, you can find us at our website, www.itcpodcast.com, Inside the Chrysalis podcast on Facebook, or at Inside the Chrysalis on Instagram. You can also leave us a rating on your podcast app, and please recommend us to your friends if you enjoyed the episode. We would love to chat with you, so you can connect with us on any of those platforms. Just so you know, all of the views we expressed on the podcast today are ours alone. We are not representing our respective organizations. So if there's something we said that you don't like, we have to take the heat all by ourselves. In addition to that, we are researchers, not counselors. So please don't take any of our advice in any kind of diagnostic capacity. So if you really enjoyed the content, want access to more, visit our Inside the Chrysalis page on Patreon and become one of our supporters to help cover our production costs. See you next time. Thanks for being here.